Hosea 2, and we are going to start at verse 2. So just the next slide, Mike. Thanks. There we go. Here we go. So, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face, and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land, and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children, because they are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers but not catch them. She will look for them but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens and my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen, intended to cover her nakedness. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed feasts. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers, but me she forgot, declares the Lord. Therefore, I am now going to allure her. I will lead her into the desert and speak tenderly to her. There, I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will sing as in the days of her youth, as in the day she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land, so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine and oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called, not my loved one. I will say to those called, not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. This is the word of the Lord. James.
Cheers. Thank you, Nico. So, the Bible can be really strange sometimes. I think a lot of the time we think of it as the good book, and we think of it as very approachable and something that's just going to give us platitudes and really nice words. I might lift this up actually slightly, just so I can, and it'll be quite cushy. But actually, it does really have the power to shock. One time I was on the train in Newcastle while I was preparing the sermon, remind me this time, I was on the train in Newcastle, and I was actually, I think I was on my way to a Bible study, or I was preparing for like a sermon or something, and had a Bible in my hand, I was looking through it, and you know how in Newcastle, Geordie, I used to live out there, Geordies are really friendly and stuff, and a woman sort of asked me, said, oh yeah, somebody was telling me, Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, there's like some really explicit stuff in there, isn't there? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, yeah, yeah, Ezekiel, somebody was telling me about it at work. And what she was talking about was this passage called Ezekiel 23, which is again, really explicit, and so explicit, so shocking, that it's sort of something that we'd never really talk about in church. But I had come across it before, so I kind of knew what she was talking about. And I just remember thinking, that's such a bold start to a conversation, sitting on a train next to somebody who's reading a Bible, going in with that. I was like, wow, okay, that's okay. Yeah, don't really know how to go with that. But I think this is shocking in a different way. This is shocking in a different way. And it does retrace a lot of the imagery that's used in that Ezekiel passage. It talks about the language of adultery. And it uses that language of adultery as kind of an image and a metaphor for people's relationship with God and Israel's relationship with God. So it's a difficult passage. Some of it, I think, you look at and it feels ancient. It's written in Old Testament times. It feels really ancient. The use of this metaphor for idolatry feels old and feels distant. But at the same time, some of it feels so modern and so relevant today, with cheating and adultery being such a ubiquitous part of life and society today, as it always has been. So last week, let's recap. So last week we heard Dan preach from Hosea 1 and Hosea 3. And we heard him talk about the first part, the sort of setup. We've got this narrative account, and it actually makes the whole book of Hosea a bit easier to understand. We learned how Hosea was commanded by God to take an adulterous wife who will cheat on him. We heard how the relationship between Hosea and his adulterous wife Gomer mirrors the relationship God have with his chosen people, Israel. How Israel kept on rejecting God and worshipping other gods, just like Gomer kept on rejecting her husband Hosea and going off with other women. So this passage now, Hosea 2, actually retreads much of the same territory as Hosea 1 and Hosea 3. It's kind of a retelling of it, but rather than being in narrative form, it's in this sort of more poetic style. And it's where we really see how Hosea's loss of love has resulted in real anger and, you know, real visceral anger and real anguish. So it is a really hard topic to talk about. I'd have to say that 10 years ago, if I was talking about this, my reference points, there'd be sort of film or TV stuff I'd see, maybe something that I'd read. But now, as I'm kind of growing older and older and all of my friends sort of are getting older with me, it's something that I see happen to actual people I know a lot more. Cheating and adultery, it isn't just some plot device in stories, it is everywhere. So what have we got here? What's the story? What's actually going on in Hosea 2? So it's a heart, it's a story of unfaithfulness, adultery and cheating. It's the story of Gomer's unfaithfulness to Hosea, and how this mirrors Israel's unfaithfulness to God. We see his anger, we see his hurt at being the party that's been cheated upon. And we see how the anger manifests itself in quite a shocking way. He talks about how he'd want to strip her of the clothing that he'd given them, how he'd like to leave her without water and food. Something that certainly in modern times is really horrifying to hear, but I think actually when it's being written then would still be a shocking passage to read. One of the things about the context of that passage that I think is important is that according to Mosaic law in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, adultery was a crime that could be punished by death. If a man or a woman was caught cheating, no, it's both a man and a woman, there's no inequality on that front, they could be punished with capital punishment. Although, thinking about it, I can't actually think of any Old Testament passages where that punishment is actually enforced, so if anyone can think of any, I may be wrong, but I just think it's interesting that that's the law that's laid down, but I don't believe it's ever enforced in the Old Testament, as far as I can remember. Perhaps catch me at the end if you can think of one, but I couldn't when I was reviewing this. So at the start of the passage, we see this anger. And it looks like Hosea is going to pursue that kind of capital punishment for adultery. He says he'll take everything back. And because this is written at a time when the wife would be particularly reliant on the husband, that would leave her in a really vulnerable position where she could not provide for herself. And so we have this angry reaction where Hosea is going to take back everything that he's given to Gomer. But verse 5 tells us that this approach only makes things worse. And it just seems to push Gomer away into the arms of her lovers. The situation gets worse, and Gomer does not even acknowledge that her clothes, food, and jewelry had come from Hosea all along. So then we go into verses 9 to 13. And then this is where the passage becomes more explicitly about God's relationship with Israel, not just Hosea and Gomer. It becomes this sort of broader metaphor, and that the imagery becomes clearer. The Israelites had been worshipping other gods. They'd been worshipping other gods like Dagon and Baal. And they worshipped those gods because they thought that those gods would provide crops and increased fertility. But God speaks through Hosea and says that it has been God providing those crops and providing that fertility all along. And that now he is going to withdraw that abundant blessing from the people of Israel. The vines and the fig trees will overgrown and will be eaten by wild animals. Celebrations and festivals will be stopped. God will remove his blessing from the land. And this will be the punishment for Israel going off and worshipping other gods. It's the punishment for forgetting God as the true provider. So the passage has started with anger at the cheating partner, and it's now building up to that punishment that's going to be meted out. And as we know, the punishment is, it can be that capital punishment, so sort of building towards that sense of, it's almost, you read it and you're almost dreading what is going to come next. You're almost fearful of what is going to happen to the cheating partner. And then we come to verse 14. And something strange happens. The passage turns, the tone shifts dramatically, just completely, a dead change. I will lead her to the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. I will give her back vineyards, and I'll make the valley of Anchor a door of hope. She will respond as in the days of her youth. Days of her youth. That phrase, it always has a certain resonance to me. I think it's a really evocative phrase. It reminds me particular of Proverbs 5. Now, the book of Proverbs 5 is basically a father advising his sons on this topic, on the topic of adultery. And he's basically warning them against this very real temptation. And it's a temptation that him as the wise father had clearly seen. He'd clearly seen friends or people around him fall into the trap of adultery. And he says, now then, my sons, listen to me. Do not turn aside from what I say. Keep to a path far from her. Do not go near the door of her house, lest you lose your honor to others and your dignity to one who is cruel, lest strangers feast on your wealth and your toil enrich the house of another. In considering that pain of adultery, he exhorts his sons, rejoice in the wife of your youth. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. I feel that phrase is sort of tinged with a certain sadness and a certain melancholy. Because I think for every son that did take his father's advice and stayed away from that path of adultery, there was likely another son who would not. We all have one of those friends who, when we were young, we sort of grew up with them, and we'd see them all the time. We'd see them all the time. You'd always be hanging out with them. You'd always be doing stuff with them. And then suddenly, you never see them again for ages. What's happened? They've suddenly met somebody. They've suddenly got a girlfriend, and they are out of the picture. They are just away with them, and they've completely forgotten about all their friends. When you do see them, they're kind of inviting their girlfriend along, and it's kind of awkward because you sort of expected it to be a lad's thing, and they're inviting their girlfriend along, and I'm sure girls had the same experience with boyfriends being invited to girls' things. But you can see that just in that youthful excitement of love, just how happy he makes her and how happy she makes him, and you can see that youthful love, that sort of real tenderness, that sort of naivety almost. This passage, the idea of the wife of your youth, hints that actually that youthful love, after all those years of partnership, just got thrown away. Was that precious love thrown away on a whim? Was it a moment of curiosity? Did it erode gradually down the arch of the years until it was finally lost? I don't think you can tell. I'm sure it's different for each case. I think the Proverbs passage makes me particularly sad because you can tell the father has seen that to marriages around him and has seen that to people around him. And he knows that his sons will be tempted to do the same. I'm reminded of the film Love Actually. I'm not sure if many people have seen it. It is quite a sort of popular film, especially around Christmas time. And it's sort of a series of different storylines. So there's lots of different storylines. And there's one in particular that always, I think, is probably the most powerful one, and it's the one that I think sticks in most people's minds when they remember that film. And it's got Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson. So Alan Rickman plays a kind of middle-aged office manager, and he's in the office, and he suddenly gets the attention of an attractive sort of young woman. And what happens is he's curious, and he kind of plays into that, and he looks into it. And he eventually sneaks out behind Emma Thompson's back. Emma Thompson is his wife. And buys a gold necklace, this beautiful gold necklace. So he buys this beautiful gold necklace for this young woman that he's met at the office. What happens is Emma Thompson finds this gold necklace in his pocket by chance. And she's really excited. She's really excited to see this, really nice present for once. And it rekindles some of their love, some of the love that they had in their youth, about her excitement of opening this present. And then it comes the day where she opens her present, and she opens it up, and it's a CD. It's not the necklace that she expected. And it's brilliant. It's kind of almost all silent, but there's this scene where she goes away, and she suddenly, the cogs are whirring, and she suddenly realizes that actually that necklace was not meant for her, it was meant for somebody else. And, I mean, she's a brilliant actress, so you really feel that sense of rejection and that, that spurned love. It's a really heartbreaking scene. Even today, there are sort of memes sort of asking how Alan Rickman's character could have possibly done that to Emma Thompson. How could you have done that to her marriage? The image of the marriage completely shattered. Even if nothing really did happen between Alan Rickman and the young woman at the office, even if it was just a one-time mistake and they got back together, there would always be that kind of grain of doubt, that loss of trust. That relationship would just not really be the same again. And there's, at the end of the film, as I said, it's multiple storylines. The idea is they all come together at the end and they meet each other at the airport. And it's a film generally about love. And it's quite nice and sort of, it's really sort of hammed up, the kind of the love element and all that sort of thing. And Alan Rickman returns to Emma Thompson and she couldn't kind of hugs him, but it's not a hug of complete love and trust. There's that kernel of doubt there that just won't be removed. And again, it's really well played by those actors and really well written. But in this passage, that is not the fate of Hosea and Gomer. And that is not the fate of Israel and God. She will respond as in the days of her youth. God will do something that will roll back the years, that will undo all the hurt, and that will wipe away all tears, making all things new. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land, so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you with justice and righteousness, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. God does not point forward to a day where Israel or Gomer return sulkily, dragging their feet because they've been starved into submission and have no choice. God's goal is not an embarrassed and ashamed people who know that the love and trust in their relationship will always bear cracks. God will speak tenderly and create a door of hope. God will remove the temptations of the Baals. He will create a covenant that brings peace. It won't be something fleeting. It'll be something permanent, something grounded in righteousness, justice, love, and compassion. Some of you here may not have experienced that day. Some of you here may be thinking, I want to know more about how God did that. I want to know more about how Jesus Christ's death could accomplish such a perfect reconciliation. And if that is you, please do come and speak to us. We'd love to be able to talk to you about the hope that we have and how you can have that hope as well. But I'm aware I'm speaking in a church, and I'm aware a lot more of you were probably thinking that in the past you have already experienced that day. You remember that day or that period of time where you repented of your sins and you received new life in Jesus. You may remember that sense of trust and purpose, the sense of excitement that your new faith brought you, how you wanted to tell everyone about it. You may remember the giddy sense of love you felt in your stomach towards Jesus, knowing your sins were forgiven. And then you might remember that slip-up you had a few days later or a few weeks later. You may remember praying for forgiveness, but feeling that somehow the trust between you and God was broken, that you had been given a clean slate, but now it wasn't quite clean anymore. It was a bit tarnished or a bit broken. You feel like you've cheated on God. Has that feeling festered? Have you felt a wedge being driven between you and God in the form of guilt and imperfection? If that is you, I think there's two things that you can do and two things that are really important to do. The first is to pray about it, to pray that guilt, that sense of tarnished relationships will be removed, and to seek out prayer with other people. And then the second one, I think, is very much the thrust of this passage. I want to remind you that no matter what, God has the power to constantly make all things new. That even though as we walk through this life, through this veil of tears, where we sin and get distracted from our faith, God has the power through Jesus to make things as they were in the days of our youth, when we first came to faith. Nothing is permanently tarnished. Nothing is totally lost. Just as God reconciles Gomer to Hosea and Israel to himself, he can reconcile us to Christ in a way that is as fresh as that faith was at first. Today, there's a jumper that I had, and somebody in this very church had complimented me on how nice that jumper was. They're not there today, but they did compliment me and say, that's a really nice jumper. And it's one of my favourites. I hadn't worn it for a few days, and I picked it off it was hanging on the wall. I thought, great, I'll wear it tonight because it's a bit smarter than it's a bit smarter and I'm preaching all that sort of thing. Picked it off the wall and put it on and realised there was a big hole in the front of it. So this jumper's wool. And having spoken to my wife, who's a bit more of an expert in woolen clothing, we realised that the moths had been at it. It'd been eaten at by the moths. And so we talked about it and we said, well, we're going back next weekend to see your mum, although it's a surprise, so don't anyone tell her that. It's her birthday. He said, can we get your mum to, like, darn it? She's really good at sewing. Can we get her to, like, darn it? And so we're going to give it a try and see what it is. But I think no matter what, that nice jumper is always on the front of it going to have some sort of blemish and some sort of imperfection. I think sometimes we think of our faith as being like that, that the sins we commit, we wear as blemishes, like the blemish on the jumper. With Christ, there are no blemishes. There are new jumpers, always. In that day, I will respond, declares the Lord. I'll respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, and the new wine, and the olive oil. They will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show you my love to the one I called not my love. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. Amen.